Danilana Kitchen talks about food. Danilana Kitchen talks recipes. Danilana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Danilana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I am Donna Prisgintos.
The Danilana Kitchen comes to you once a week from the beautiful downtown studios in Ames, Iowa. Beautiful downtown studios of KHOI Community Radio. Just off Main Street. We gather around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, recipes, advice, opinions. We kind of cover all sorts of things here and find out what's cooking in Central Iowa.
And boy, are we in the midst of a great harvest season.
Despite the fact that it seems the rest of the Midwest is getting lots of rain, Central Iowa, I read Central Iowa is kind of moving on toward the drought end of things officially. They're like got their maps up and we're colored bright orange and we're colored yellow, which means we're dry here, folks. We are dry right here in Central Iowa.
We're not as dry as we were, though. I hate to complain.
We did have a little bit of rain, but we're talking rain for like all that corn. It kind of needs lots of it. But we'll see what the weather brings. We have had beautiful weather because despite being a drought, it's been cool and nice. Nice to sit out, enjoy the summer evenings. I went to, this past weekend, I went to a outdoor concert. They have them every Sunday evening at the Roosevelt Park here in Ames. Not the nice folks gather. And there aren't any mosquitoes. There's just music and people in lawn chairs.
That is the good thing about the drought, is we don't have very many mosquitoes this year. It's fabulous.
So nice time to just plain sit outside.
Got to count your blessings.
So today we're going to talk about some garden bounty because it is bounty this time of year. Donna's got a few words about eggs. We'll consider the state fair. The state fair is coming up, and at the state fair, Iowa State Fair, they celebrate big things. They have big cows. They have
big pigs.
Big pigs. They have big horses. Oh, I heard the Clydesdale, the Budweiser Clydesdale horses are going to be there.
Oh, they're so pretty, aren't they?
They're pretty. That another big thing, and the big vegetables. And so we have a
farmer interview.
Farmer interview from Nick Odie from Practical Farmers of Iowa, our man in the field. He talked to somebody who grows vegetables on sort of the big side for the Iowa State Fair. And we also have some news items from the Danilana Kitchen News Department. So we have a full show today here. So first let's consider garden stuff.
Donna, well, you're the garden queen here, Lana.
Yeah, well, Donna, you gave me some seeds for some Trombocino squash, and I have a Trombocino squash update. I haven't grown those for many years, and I forgot just how big they get and how quick.
Well, they're kind of, I believe they are actually in the butternut squash family. Mm-hmm. However, they grow kind of like zucchinis.
They grow, and this year I was good enough to put them on a small trellis so they're not all in a pile on the ground. These Trombocino squash are a very long squash with a bulb on the end. Actually, kind of funny looking sort of things. And they get bigger and bigger and bigger. Matter of fact, the look of them could also put them, it looks like some sort of device that
you
might
find. Does it look like a trombone?
Well, it's long. It's got a lump on the end. But I was thinking more of something you might find in a X-rated adult sort of establishment.
Oh, Lana,
They're just these pointy, long things with a nubbly on the end. But I ate one last night. A Trombocino squash is a delightful squash because, picture this long, skinny thing. Unfortunately, I let one grow to, I measured it, 39 inches.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that
Lana,
was.
Lana, I'm astounded.
Yeah. That one got a little hard.
It was an oversight, sure.
That one got a little hard. But I picked one that was about a foot long. Well, maybe
that's eight, about perfect.
Yeah, about 80 inches. What's nice about these squash, it's a light green, long, with a little lump at the end. There are no seeds in the long neck of this thing. So you can just chop the whole thing up.
And how did you like the flavor?
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah, they're mild.
They're mild?
But I find them a little more flavorful than your normal zucchini.
And they're not as, because the seeds are all kind of congealed into one end,
uh-huh.
I find them nice and firm. They
yeah,
don't,
they're not
yeah.
as they're not kind as watery. Of watery.
No,
there you
huh?
go. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Here's a shout out to Trombocino, trombone. Squash.
Yeah, well, folks, maybe I'll get Lana to grow some for market next year. We'll
now,
see.
Now, I have tried that. That is one of those things that I would suggest people grow and use them at home because they don't transport well. When they're at their prime, they bruise very easily.
Oh, really?
They
oh.
really do. So mm. it's kind of like those big sloppy tomatoes that you just want to use two hands. Yes, you can get them to market, but
they're just too delicate. I'm surprised. I mean, I have mine growing up the fence in mm-hmm. my backyard. I only have one skinny little one so far that I haven't even picked. But I don't get as much sun in my yard as Lana
does. It takes time.
So.
It takes time. And I do have some other ones coming, and I do like the taste. I have tried to take them to market before, and a long time ago. And about half the people looking at them say, "Ew, what is that? Oh, icky, I couldn't eat that." And, you know how people are. You know,
oh, yeah. right, okay. And anything then, a little out of the ordinary.
And,
okay.
And also, they do bruise really easily. So, but I would suggest you grow them right outside your kitchen
right, they're
door.
They're really easy to grow.
They're easy to grow. And that idea of
they're
not having
seeds. They're fun for kids.
And not having seeds to uh-huh. fool around with. There uh-huh. we go. So, your Trombocino squash.
I think I got the seeds from... what's the place up in Decorah? Seeds of Change?
Seed Savers.
Seed Savers.
Yeah.
Seed Savers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Seeds of Change is another lovely organization
right.
in the Southwest.
Right. Okay. So, no, these are Seed Savers.
Seed
Savers. Our very own Iowa. I just ordered them online.
Very good. A good summer squash. Let's talk about something else from the garden. My good friend Paula Widener from here in Ames, she sent this recipe along to me. You get basil this time of year, and everybody thinks pesto. Pesto's good. Pesto's good. And I hope that you are making use of basil that you come across, whether that you buy or that you grow. And it's lovely. You can put that in the do up little bags of pesto and put them in the freezer, and you just smug.
Now, Lana, here's the dilemma. Mm. My basil is looking really good, and I have Thai basil and lemon basil. And I want to, how do I keep it from going to flower head and seeding out and just going?
Good sound effect there, Donna. Yes. The basil responds to summer heat, which we don't have a lot of, but it does like to grow and grow. And eventually it will put out flowers on the top, which means the plant says, okay, I'm done.
Are we supposed to pinch those
you
little
can,
guys off?
Yes, you can pinch them off if you're just using little bits. I have really good luck with being rather firm with them and cutting them off, actually about 4 inches from the ground, the whole plant. Be sure to leave some leaves on the bottom there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you cut them off severely and use that big stalk of basil to make pesto or dry it or something, and water it a little bit, it will come back this time of year because as the flowers are forming on the top of the basil plant, the basil gets a little woody in the stalk and
mm-hmm.
a little sharp in the taste.
Right.
So
yeah, can get bitter.
So feel free to trim. Trim
all right,
severely.
I'm going home and getting my scissors
out. Do that.
Okay.
So let's talk about this recipe. It's not basil pesto. It is a recipe from a website called www.davidliebowitz.com. And my friend...
He is a good recipe writer. I approve of him.
Oh, very good. See,
yes.
There you go. Yeah, Paula seemed to think highly of this website, too. So David Liebowitz, Living the Sweet Life in Paris is what is the easy subtitle for his
mm-hmm.
thing here. And he has a recipe for basil vinaigrette. And I never thought of doing this. This sounds real good, Donna.
Right. So he uses the blender.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually, I do this quite frequently myself. You can always just make a vinegar and oil salad dressing mm-hmm. with a little salt and pepper. But when I put them in the blender, his recipe here is a half cup of olive oil. Try to use a decent one. A tablespoon and a half of red or white wine vinegar. He adds a tablespoon of water. A small shallot peeled and sliced. A teaspoon of Dijon mustard. Of course, the French always put mustard in their vinaigrette. 3/4 teaspoon of salt. And 2 cups of loosely packed fresh basil leaves. Now, that's a pretty good amount. Mm-hmm. And then you just kind of put it all in and blend it up. I often put fresh herbs when I do it in the blender. You could use tarragon. You could use dill, certainly garlic. And once you the blender will give you the emulsification, and this looks like a really, it should come up pretty green.
Pretty green. And mm-hmm. instead of just a vinaigrette, which I always think of as just kind of a runny sort of thing, it sounds like it's got some body to it.
Well, with that much basil mm-hmm. leaf in it, you've got all that plant matter. So mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess that's why he puts the water in. It sounds yummy to me. I think I may try it.
Yeah. It says this basil vinaigrette can be used right away or will keep for a week in the refrigerator. It's best served at room temperature.
I have to tell you, it will probably separate.
Okay. So you just stir it around with a fork and have
mm-hmm,
at it.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Something else, he says, this David Leibovitz, the creator of this recipe or the passer along of this recipe, says, this especially lively vinaigrette is perfect with tomatoes. Could go with a variety of other things.
Yeah, I was thinking tomatoes. How mm-hmm. easy could that be?
Yeah. Burrata, mozzarella, feta cheese, grilled vegetables, fish, pork, shrimp. Put a little over white bean dip just before serving. That sounds really good. So this is a different way to use basil, and it'll have a bit more kick because of the vinegar in it. But I ran across a term in his little introduction here that I have no idea what it is. Donna, burrata. What is a burrata? B-U-R-R-A-T-A.
Okay, it is a super duper kind of mozzarella.
Oh.
Somehow in the cheese processing, I wish I knew how to explain these things. It makes a sort of a little sack with a kind of a skin, a milk skin on the outside. And inside is almost ricotta-like, soft. But it's in the mozzarella family. So you can actually slice it, and you could make a caprese salad with it. I have seen it in some cheese departments in town here. Mostly it's in Italy, it's made with buffalo milk, which is extremely delicious. But it's often made with cow's milk here. I think there's some made in one of the Wisconsin cheesemakers. There's some California cheesemakers making it. Usually comes in a little plastic container with the mozzarella water around it.
Ah, yes.
And it's quite delicate.
Okay. Well, that's something to look for. B-U-R-R-A-T-A. Something to put underneath your basil vinaigrette. That sounds
good. And with tomatoes, too.
Oh, very nice.
Or it's so good you just might stick a spoon in it and eat away.
A recommendation. Yes, a recommendation. What sort of other, you said you do this vinaigrette sort of thing. What sort of other herbs could you put in a vinaigrette like this and mix it up?
Well, as I said, certainly dill. We got plenty of dill right now. Mm-hmm. If you're going the least bit, like I might make one with Thai basil and a dab of curry powder, maybe a fresh clove of garlic, and what else have we got in the garden that would go in that? That might be enough,
yeah.
The Thai basil.
Yeah.
And you could switch the vinaigrette to using rice wine vinegar mm-hmm. and kind of go that direction.
That's right. You mentioned using good quality olive oil, but yes, you should use a good quality vinegar too, not the kind of thing that you might just, you know.
Right, you don't want the white distilled vinegar.
No, that kind of
or
stuff.
Or even the apple cider vinegar. The pH is wrong. It's
right.
Too acidic.
It's good. Well, actually, I always think of the white vinegar as stuff to clean your windows.
Exactly.
That's handy.
That's fine.
Very
with me.
Handy.
That's about
yes,
all
is.
I use it for. It's a solvent.
It is. So, good vinegar. Good vinegar, yes. That's good. All right. That is basil vinaigrette. Thanks to Paula Widener for sending that our way. And you can find out more on this website that she recommends, www.davidleibovitz.com. Leibovitz.
Leibovitz.
Yes. And Donna says he's got some good ideas.
His cookbooks are often quite good. He writes a lot about, he's been living in Paris for a number of years, so he really writes about French food in a very entertaining way. And he is, as I said, a good recipe writer.
Very good. Always want to look out for them. Good. Well, we're going to stay in the kitchen for a minute. And Donna, you have a egg experiment here, a hard-boiled egg experiment.
Oh, yes. My friend Carolyn was, here's one of our little kitchen tips that we have. Every once in a while, I try to learn a new trick or two in the kitchen. And so Carolyn and I were having dinner the other night, and she was very excited about a new method she had found for peeling hard-boiled eggs. And I have to say, I love egg salad. However, I don't like peeling eggs. You know, it can be very, very tedious. And you read all these things, well, if you use older eggs or if you boil them this way, rah, 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 rah. So Carolyn had a method that she found on the internet, and it's a really simple one, and I tried it, and I'm going to pass it on to you. You boil them however you usually do.
Now, the thing about older eggs, just fresh out of the chicken, in my experience, really, truly, they are harder to peel because... because
they're fresh.
They're very fresh, and there's not a lot of space in the egg underneath the shell.
Well, I suppose if we wanted to be really scientific, we should use this new trick with fresh eggs and old eggs.
Okay.
However, the eggs that I had in my refrigerator were at least more than a week old.
Okay. All right, that's good.
So I just put a dozen of them in the pan, and I boiled them at the proper time in the just normal way. And then I let them cool down a bit, not all of the way, and I poured some of the water out so that there was only like an inch of water in the pan. And then here's the trick from Carolyn. So you put the lid on the pan, and you put it like on the counter or something, and you shake it vigorously for about 10 seconds.
Huh.
And then all the shells kind of shatter and crack around, and they slip right off.
Really?
And the video that I watched that she sent to me said, if 10 seconds doesn't do it, do it for another 5 seconds. So it's really, really, it's like, you know how when you're making popcorn in a pan and you just shuffle it around?
The old-fashioned way
of making popcorn. Yes, the old-fashioned way. So I just had the pan with the lid on, of course, because otherwise it's all over the place. And you just... it reminded me of roller derby for the eggs or something, you know? And it really, really was simple. I'm going to do it again.
So they kind of peel off together. I would think
that
you'd be...
Well, they get kind of uniformly cracked all over the place, and then they slip off much more easily.
Well, that's nice. Because I've always taken a hard-boiled egg and hit it on the fat end or on the big end of
right.
the egg, because I thought, well, that's where the air bubble is. That's where I should start. With varying success.
Yeah, so, yeah. Sometimes you're picking off every little piece, and it's so tedious.
All right. Let's experiment with our eggs here.
A new little old-fashioned trick. A new old trick, I suppose.
A new old trick. Good. Mm-hmm. Oh, I've got another little thing to mention about eggs. You know how chickens are the source of a lot of vernacular and truisms and like henpecked and
which came
peckish.
First, the chicken or the egg?
And here I'm going to talk about the term nest egg here. Nest egg could be your IRA or your piggy bank, but this is the time of year I'm looking forward to my new 4-month-old hens that I got as baby chicks back in April. Any day now, I think. Any day. They're going to start to want to lay because I'm looking forward to some eggs again. Oh, they are. And I thought, well, usually I have old hens that will kind of, I figured they'll teach the new hens. But this year we started.
Oh, right. You don't have any old
hens
this year.
I have no mentors.
There was a massacre by a mink out at Lana's farm.
Yeah. So I'm starting out with a brand new flock. I haven't had a brand new flock for a whole week. They look great. But I'm thinking, How do they know? And this trick.
Well, how do they know where you want the eggs?
Where? And, well, they are closed into the hen house for at night, and then so that'll help. But with a light and all that kind of thing, I have a couple nest eggs, a fake wooden egg
You can find them. You can actually, you can use them as to darn socks with if you're talking about old-fashioned ways to make popcorn. Does anybody darn socks anymore? But there we have it. It's an egg, but it's not a real egg. You don't want to put a real egg in there because chickens tend to peck and they say, oh, lunch.
No, they'll just eat it.
They'd eat it. Oh, boy, lunch, they'd say. But this, the chickens are going to be looking for a place to kind of snuggle down. And if they snuggle down and kind of look and see this other egg, I'm hoping that they will say, ha, I've got it now. I've got four nest boxes. And here's another trick. I don't know if anybody else does this, but I get the local paper, and I always end up with lots more newspaper, newsprint than I know what to do with. But at a garage sale, I came home one day with a paper shredder. So I shred my local paper, after reading it cover to cover and doing the crossword puzzle, I shred my local paper, and the chicken nest box is full of crumpled up newsprint.
Huh? Now that's recycling.
That's recycling. It just for the size of flock that I have, and it just is handy. And why recycle or take all that stuff into the recycling when I can just put it underneath my chickens, and it does compost eventually.
Yes, it will biodegrade.
Yeah, there you go. So there's my nest egg, and I am waiting for
my food. Well, now, when they lay on that, do they ever come out with newspaper printing on the eggshell?
No, I haven't noticed on the eggshell. But there is that, actually, there is a very embarrassing, like, coming out of the restroom sort of problem where sometimes they get some long strings of newsprint wrapped around their feet, and they're kind of dragging this thing. You know, it's like when the toilet paper gets stuck in an inopportune place. But
those chickens.
But that's fine. They can deal with it. So there's your nest egg. There is your hard-boiled egg experiment. Thank you, Donna, for talking about that new old way to do hard-boiled eggs. You're listening to KHOI 89.1. This is Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was some fine banjo from Bob Black, fine Iowa banjo player. He's just a great musician. Love his stuff. Ladies on the Steamboat is what that was called. It's August. It's Iowa. The Iowa State Fair is coming up. Yes. And I hear that everybody likes fair food. There are going to be, they promise, 75 delectable items on a stick. So get busy, get busy. And they're going to have a hot dog eating contest and all sorts of big things to look at. And don't worry, folks, besides big
things that are going to be up for blue ribbons, there is more parking. What could make people more happy?
Really, more parking and cooler weather.
More parking and cooler weather. That is very, very good. People go to the state fair for many reasons, and people go and enjoy how people bring their best to the state fair. Next, we have an excerpt from Practical Farmers of Iowa, new podcast and KHOI show on farm. Our man in the field, Nick Odie, talked to a man who grows larger than usual vegetables. If you've ever wondered, where do they come from? This man, Marty Schnichter, is a grower of large vegetables.
I mean really large.
Yes, last month.
Like the typical large pumpkin at a fair is, I mean, I don't know how many pounds, but let's say they're what do you think they are, 4 feet in diameter or something?
As big as this table. It's pretty scary.
They're different.
Yeah. Yeah. Recently, Nick Odie interviewed this fine farmer, and he hosted a PFI field day on July 15th. He has a farm in southeast Iowa.
Have you ever wondered how they grow those giant veggies at the state fair? This week on the show, we have the answer. With us today is Marty Schnicker of Schnicker Specialties, who farms with his wife Mary near Mount Pleasant in southeast Iowa. Marty knows how to grow really big vegetables. He holds the Iowa state record for heaviest watermelon grown, tipping the scales at 209 pounds. But watermelons aren't the only thing. They grow big everything, from cabbage to cantaloupe to the favorite, pumpkin.
You know, everybody goes, well, how much fertilizer? Go, well, it's not really the fertilizer. It's just all the organic supplements we're putting into the soil that feed in the soil, from the cover crops to the compost to everything that we're feeding that soil, bringing in the microbes, bringing in the earthworms. Anything that's beneficial is living in this soil. So it's just amazing what these plants can do if you get your soil and everything just right.
On the show, we'll find out how these giant vegetables are grown and how big but maybe not state record vegetables sell well at the farmer's market. So a 209-pound watermelon, how big is that? Can you give me a comparison? Is this like the size of a small car?
It's a good size. It'll fill up the back of a minivan in the back. It was about 70 inches around in the middle. If you can figure out 70 inches around or how big somebody's waist is. So it was very, very fat melon. Plus, it was about 3 foot long in length. So it was really a lot to try to carry and handle. I don't know, would you be a small pig probably? Not quite for market or really close to market size. So that's what a lot of people kind of compared it to. Was like, well, that looks like a hog laying there when it was out in the patch. So that's how big it was.
So maybe you could walk me through the process on one of those things, like a watermelon. How does that start, and how's it different from just, you know, growing a good, nice watermelon for the market or something?
Of course, when you're going to watermelons, we still want to get the soil pretty much pumped up like we do our pumpkin. So we're going with a really loamy, well-balanced soil, actually very high in everything nutrient-wise. And then we're going to get a seed from a proven watermelon, so something that's been big. And it's got genetics in it. It's been crossed. It's been hand-pollinated. We know what the genetics is behind it. It's not open-pollinated. So we know we're getting a good genetic seed, and then we start them inside about the end of March, 1st of April, because we want something outside and pollinated at least before July. For the state fair, of course, we have to start a lot earlier than that, but for something to get 200 pounds or bigger, we have to get them outside pretty good time, because they're going to grow 85 to 105 days to get them full size. So once we get the plant out there, we're babying it, we're getting it down. There's not a lot of pruning that goes along with the watermelons compared to the pumpkins, but we want to try to get a nice long melon set on. We hand pollinate them. We put fabric underneath of them. We shade them. We don't let the sun hit them. And we're constantly measuring them about every other day to see how they're doing. We have to move them because they're growing both directions. They try to keep the stem straight on them, so they're not going to get a kink in it. So there's a lot of upkeep with them, keeping the bugs off, keep ventilation on them. We try to set one fruit, no more than two on a plant. If we can, just one. If I have enough plants, I can just do one on a plant. But if I'm limited on my area to grow them, I'll actually put two on. So that's kind of what we want to do. We just let those plants kind of do what they want, and we just feed them as much organic stuff as possible and just kind of watch the plant, monitor it, make sure it's still growing well, and just go for the ride from there. Once we get it going, we just kind of watch it, keep the soil levels, moisture levels consistent, and just enjoy it. That's the fun part of it.
You mentioned a little bit about, you know, trying to put amendments in the soil. What kind of fertilizer requirements do these things take? I mean, how much are they using?
They're using quite a bit of nutrients. We prep everything in the fall. If we bring in, I mean, I've been known to bring in like 15 dump trucks full of decomposed manures, or going somewhere and getting a load of compost and just piling it. And then in the fall, I just amend this soil constantly every year. We're putting at least 2 inches of new compost on top of the soil, getting it worked into it. We put some cover crops on it. We'll work the cover crops in if we have time to get that all into the soil. Leaves, I mean, I go and I get, you know, hundreds of bags of leaves, shred them up. We move them. We put them on in the fall and work them in. So this soil is so organic and so pumped up and loose. You know, it's like we could get 2 inches of rain, and then the next day you're out working in the soil because it's draining so well, and the roots have so much area to go. It's just amazing how far these roots on these plants will go out beyond that pumpkin with such a good organic and so loose soil.
So in one sense, it's just a kind of an intensification of the things that are just good for any plant to grow in.
And that's the whole thing is, you know, we'll get normal vegetables out there, and they're twice as big as anything out just in a normal garden, just from the nutrient level that we're feeding these plants, you know. And it's so, you know, everybody goes, well, how much fertilizer? You go, well, it's not really the fertilizer. It's just all the organic supplements we're putting into the soil that's feeding the soil from the cover crops to the compost to everything that we're feeding that soil, is bringing in the microbes, bringing in the earthworms, anything that's beneficial is living in the soil. So it's just amazing what these plants can do if you get your soil and everything just right.
You also grow a lot of vegetables for, you sell at a farmer's market in Mount Pleasant. Is that what?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what are some of the vegetables you sell there? And do you sell some slightly bigger veggies there that sell well?
Usually the onions. Once the onions are done, the onions are a big. You know, everybody wants to brag about the onions. So they want to come and buy one of those 4 or 5 pound onions, the sweet onions. So they're a wonderful onion ring maker, you know. And, you know, everybody, conversation piece. We'll bring in some of the jumbo kohlrabi. We'll bring in the big cabbages and stuff. They'll usually win best of show at the fair here in Henry County because they're just absolutely gorgeous cabbage, but they're huge. You know, so everybody loves to see that big stuff. It makes great conversation at the farmer's market table. We bring them in. Sometimes we'll bring them in something that's a guest to wait for to win some free produce or something. You know, we'll do something like that just to get people involved. And, you know, we don't just do vegetables, you know. So what we sell at farmer's market, a lot of heirloom stuff. And that's the thing with a lot of these giant things. They're all heirloom fruit. It's things that's been growing, been around for years. You know, so there's not any what you call anything really different out there. It's just we're bringing back a lot of the heirloom stuff. The German giant radishes are kind of our claim to fame for farmers market because our German giant radishes are baseball to softball size and totally solid, you know, because our soil is so pumped up and so delicious for those plants to grow in, you know. So it just everybody just loves those German giants. They're so tender and moist. They're not hard like a rock or anything. They're just so tender. So a lot of people make radish sandwiches out of these jumbo radishes. So that's something that we kind of got a claim on here is with our radishes. Of course, you know, we don't sell many of the giant watermelon. We don't have a lot of them to sell, but we always said that'd be great for a family reunion. You know, heck, one watermelon will feed everybody. So we actually did that 1 year. We cut one up and during the harvest season, and everybody was out in the field, and we just drove around and handed watermelon to anybody that was out in the field in a tractor or whatever, gave them a Tupperware thing full of watermelon just to try to get rid of it. So there was so much watermelon in that big watermelon, so we got rid of it that way, and it was really good too.
So even the great big ones, they're tasty too?
Yes, yes. So it depends on the year. You know, the more stress they have, the more sugars they release. So they always say, you know, if you get a cold snap or a hot snap, it kind of stresses the plant to produce more sugar. So everybody always talks about when it's a hot year, how much, you know, how good the sweet corn is, because all that heat turns everything into sugars. So, and the tomatoes are a lot the same way. You know, the summertime tomatoes are so delicious. And then in the fall, when the weather cools, they say, well, the tomatoes just don't have the flavor as they did earlier. It's just because of the weather, you know. So it's keeping everything, the stress from whatever, the coldness and the heat, will produce more sugars into the vegetables and give them more flavor. So it's just, you know, so much depends on Mother Nature and how your weather is and how much rain you're getting or not getting. You know, that turns this produce, you know, into fantastic food for farmers markets and flavors. And of course, the heirlooms all have different, their own unique flavor when it comes to tomatoes. So it's nice to have an abundance of different types of tomatoes for people to taste. Everybody's taste is different.
Well, Marty, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you, Nick.
That was a fine interview to a grower with a grower of very, very large vegetables, Marty Schnichter. And that was our man in the field, Nick Odie. You can listen to the whole interview and learn how to subscribe to the show at practicalfarmers.org/podcast, or catch new episodes of On Farm, produced by Nick Odie, on KHOI on Saturday mornings at 9 p.m. A.M. Sorry,
right.
9 a.m.
Farmers, 9 a.m.
Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. All right. Thanks, Nick, for that interview. Practical Farmers of Iowa is a fine organization, and they have field days, which means you can go out. You could go out and see this. See,
you can
big
visit
vegetables.
The farm.
You can visit the farm. Yes, you can. We're going to take a little break here and do a golden oldie from the year 1897 from the Grange Songbook, sung by a fine musician named Anne Percival. She gives a little modern twist to this fine tune. You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen.
Count your blessings, I name them one by one. Count your blessings, see what love has done. Count your blessings, name them one by one. Count your many blessings, see what love has done. Oh, when up on life's billows, oh, you are tempest-tossed. Oh, when you are discouraged, thinking all is lost. Count your many blessings, oh, name them one by one. And it will surprise you what that love has done. So count your blessings, oh, name them one by one. Count your blessings, see what love has done. Count your blessings, name them one by one. Count your many blessings, see what love has done. Are you ever burdened with a load of care? Or does that cross seem heavy you are called to bear? Count your many blessings, every doubt will fly, and you will be singing as the days go by. Well, I say count your blessings, or name them one by one. Your blessings, see what love has done. Count your blessings, I name them one by one. Count your many blessings, see what love has done.
We are back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more about the Donna Lana Kitchen at the website, khoifm.org. And you can find the Donna Lana Kitchen webpage there. There is archive of all past shows. If you can't just get enough of us, there is a recipe page. There's a picture of Donna and I. Yeah, there is. There is. It's khoifm.org. This is community radio, which means we are all here because we want to be. We are all volunteers doing a fine job of talking about and talking to and learning about Central Iowa and all the good things we have here. So we're going to be considering a few things from the Donalana Kitchen News Department. Tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick. That's your Donalana Kitchen ticker tape. It goes off every now and then, and we pull up some interesting food-based items, things that affect our kitchen table. What do you have for us, Donna?
Well, we got a couple of things coming from our federal government here that, you know, it kind of makes me want to laugh.
Well?
I mean, it's funny, you know, little, I mean, what are you going to do? You got to laugh. So here's the, you know that when Congress comes back from vacation, they are going to take up the tax agenda. Mm-hmm. And apparently they're going to try to cut taxes. And some of us are a bit suspicious that they're not cutting the taxes for us normal folks. They're really trying to cut the taxes on the fairly already fortunate people. But so one thing that's going on is they are looking to eliminate the estate tax, or the death tax,
We have been hearing about that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So here's a little, this is from an op-ed piece by Chuck Collins. I'm just going to do a couple little quotes. So, passed a century ago at the urging of President Theodore Roosevelt, this estate tax is a levy on millionaire inheritances. It puts the brakes on the concentration of wealth and political power and raises substantial revenue over a quarter of $1 trillion over the next decade if it's kept from the richest 0.1%. So we're only talking about the big spenders, okay?
Not me, not you.
No. But here's the rub. Lobbyists are trying to put a populist spin on their efforts to abolish this tax, because we can all imagine if it's only for the 1% of the 1%, it's not going to garner a lot of popular, you know, I mean, who's going to support that? Not very many of us, folks. Anyway, so they're putting a populist spin on the efforts to get rid of this tax. Puzzlingly, they're deploying farmers as the props for this PR campaign, and they're claiming that the tax means the death of the family farm. So you will be seeing a lot of farmers trotted out saying, you know, if we don't get rid of this tax, we're going to lose the family farm. Well, apparently this accusation is pure manure.
Uh-huh.
Because only households with the wealth starting at $11 million or individuals of $55.5 million are subject to this tax.
So it doesn't, like, bring a lot of farmers to mind? But...
No. But according to the Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, he says, this hurts a lot of farmers. Many people have to sell their family farms. Now, that is a direct quote. But a new report by our president's own U.S. Department of Agriculture shows that this claim is bull, as they say, that only 4 out of every 1,000 farmers will owe any estate tax at all, that the effective tax rate on these small farms is a modest only 11%. So, you know, the few farmers that are going to be hit with this death tax, as it's called, are people like Ted Turner's ranch in Montana, for example. So, you know, you'll be seeing a lot of farmers trotted out to say, oh, this is affecting family farms. Well, you know, it's not true. Just don't go for it. It is a big PR campaign to try to get us poorer people to be sympathetic. It says, this op-ed goes on to say, all this farm talk mystifies those who actually pay the tax. Most estate taxpayers live in big cities and wealthy states such as New York, Florida, and California, and very few have probably ever driven a tractor.
So there.
So with the coming tax debate, watch out for the advertisements and the sound bites about farmers and the estate tax. The tax lobbyist for billionaires will be pulling the strings, and I'm afraid they may be pulling our leg.
Ooh.
So that's one thing from the federal government. Now we have another funny, I mean, I think it's funny. People are really up in arms about this. But apparently the USDA has been told to avoid the term climate change.
Avoid.
Yes, avoid it. So they have been instructed to there's a new guide that was provided by someone named Bianca Mobius-Klune. So they're instructed to say, rather than climate change, they're to say weather extremes.
Okay.
And rather than climate change adoption, they are to say, use resilience to weather extremes or intense weather. They also are supposed to say, rather than reducing greenhouse gases, they're supposed to say, build soil organic matter and increase nutrient use efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than saying sequester carbon, they're supposed to say, build soil organic matter. Now, of course, some environmentalists are all up in arms. Oh, we're being censored. We're being blah, blah, blah. However, I don't think this is just my opinion. I don't think it's such a big deal. Because sooner or later, everybody's going to notice that the weather's changing, no matter what we call it. You know, it is becoming obvious. And if we're using terminology that is perhaps less polarizing, maybe that's okay.
Well, I don't know. I kind of disagree with you there, Donna. When somebody tells you you can't use certain words, that gets kind of strange, especially when this kind of...
Well, it is the government, yes.
Yeah, this kind of verbiage comes out in things like USDA report, soil science. It's kind of sounds like they're kind of trying to put a break on scientists and people that try to measure things.
Well,
I think
that's certainly a possibility, and I suspect that is what they think they're doing. But if you look at the words that they want to use, I mean, after all, we used to call climate change global warming.
Uh-huh.
And then people
true.
Decided that that gave the wrong picture because some places are, in fact, going to get colder. So global warming wasn't really the most accurate term. So then we chose climate change. And then I feel like in the press, people have become – it's become a polarizing word, you know, like – The left wing really likes to use climate change. The right side of the government, not so much. So
mm-hmm.
If you call it climate change, and that makes people a fairly significant or at least a not insignificant part of the population, if it makes them not able to deal with the concept, if simply using weather extremes does the trick, I'm happy to change the language because we're not going to change the science and we're not really going to change the effects. Sooner or later, you know, those big storms are going to become obvious to everyone.
Right. So let's talk about it, whatever we call
it. Yeah, let's just – I'm for using whatever's effective. You know?
All right. Oh, another news item here. Glyphosate. This is one of my least favorites. This has been around for a couple months here, but be careful out there because they're finding Monsanto, Roundup, glyphosate in, of all places, Ben and Jerry's ice cream. What is the world coming to?
Well, I mean, I think people have just begun to test for it a little bit more because, in fact, as we know here in Iowa, it is ubiquitous. It is everywhere. We do live in a sea of glyphosate out there and all that corn and soybeans. And, of course, if they're feeding it to the mm-hmm. cows, then it's going to, you know, somehow end up in the food system. So there's been a bit more testing of it. And the consumers are up in arms that there is glyphosate in their Ben & Jerry's ice cream. So the funny part of it is... there's been a campaign to ask Ben and Jerry's to become organic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think this is a strange incidence of where actually the consumers are pressuring a large corporation because, of course, Ben and Jerry's is no longer just Ben and Jerry's. It's owned by somebody big. It could be Unilever, but I'm not sure which one it is. But anyway, one of the large food conglomerates does own Ben & Jerry's, and they are now being asked by a large body of their consumers to go organic, which of course means that the cows will not be fed genetically modified corn and soybeans, which has not been sprayed with glyphosate.
Right. And just think, it comes through the cows to us. Oh, that makes for happy ice cream eating. Okay. Oh, dear. Well, okay, one more Donalana Kitchen news item here. This is not actually a very happy thing, but this is a day to remember that this is the 72nd anniversary of the U.S., that's us, U.S., dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Remember, we did that, folks. And also on August 9th, 1945, we dropped a second atomic bomb on Nagasaki. Let's remember our history.
Yeah, and let's remember that, you know, some of that research was done right here in Ames.
So let's remember.
It's locally tied to us.
When we think we can't affect large areas and large populations and large parts of our planet, think of that.
And
think
big
of
pieces
that.
Of history.
The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons says Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings killed over 200,000 people in 1945 and left a legacy of chronic disease still felt today. So,
and in Ames, we have our own Reactor Woods.
We do. Remember why it's named that, folks. Yes, we do. So that's a little bit of the news items. We have some upcomings. Well, we'll be talking about the eclipse. Oh, everybody's up in arms or up in a tizzy about the eclipse. That happens in a week or so.
Now, Lana, do you have any idea how much of it are we going to actually see in Ames? Do you know?
I don't know. It won't be some.
Well, it's partial, but we'll see some of it, right?
Oh, yeah, we'll see some of it.
Yeah.
I just because I'm a kind of conservative person, I'm not going to be jumping in my car and trying to get underneath the path. I figure it'll do fine without me, and you can always watch it on the internet. Yeah, that's fine. But I know it's an important thing. It is an important thing, and we think that we are a pretty small planet out there, and it kind of puts us in our place. I do like that. I do like that.
Well, I was reading a little bit of Annie Dillard because she has a nice piece written about an eclipse that she saw, and it made me realize that, you know, we really take our solar, the sun comes up in the morning and it goes down at night, and the light looks a certain way, and, you know, these diurnal rhythms are very important part of our life that we just take for granted. And in her piece, maybe we'll read a little bit from it next week, she talks about what the disruption of that does and how it startles your brain into realizing these forces of nature are, you know, they're just so
big.
They're big. Yeah, they're really, really big. We'll read some Annie Dillard next week.
We will.
Because she's pretty articulate about it.
Good, good. Oh, and another upcoming thing, the Ames Downtown Farmers Market is having a salsa contest.
Now, that's not the dancing salsa. That's the salsa.
The eating salsa. You can come and dance, I'm sure, too. But they have really good cooking contests. There's a salsa contest. For more information, go to AmesDowntownFarmersMarket.com. They have a explanation of all of that
there. Because we got good tomatoes now.
And also, August 12th, the KHOI birthday celebration.
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Cake.
Yes.
Music. Dancing.
Bake a cake if you would like and bring it along with you for our birthday cake potluck. Or just bring a fork and enjoy all the cake.
Yeah,
there's
we would really enjoy tasting your favorite cake. If you want to show a little love for KHOI, Lana and I will be sort of curating the cake potluck, and we'll be here. So it's and it's next.
So next Saturday, August 12th.
This coming Saturday.
Come in the afternoon, and there's a special performance. There's going to be lots of music and performances by everybody.
Late afternoon.
And Sam Salomon will perform from 6 to 9 on his mighty Hammond B3 organ. Come and hear some really fine jazz. Eat some birthday cake. Celebrate this fine radio station.
Yeah. Free music in the streets. Come on.
KHOI just keeps getting better. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We'll go out with some more Bob Black banjo music, Jerusalem Ridge. Join us here every Tuesday at noon, repeated at 7 p.m. Support Community Radio. Happy birthday to KHOI. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.